sun, 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 sun. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel of on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be with you.
And last week, there was an extraordinarily important story that came out as a result of instrument readings in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on the top of the volcano on the Big Island of Hawaii that indicate that the atmospheric CO2 concentration has surpassed 400 parts per million. And this milestone, of course, here we are about a week later, and it's all but forgotten. All the press are going on about is this incredibly fictional Benghazi story, the absurd overkill against the IRS, who can actually be accused of not doing their job in terms of all the money that's pouring into politics. And, of course, Eric Holder being beaten up and everybody saying now Obama's finished. But, hey, wait a minute. Is the planet finished? What are we talking about here?
Well, you know, it is unfortunate that a story this important sort of disappears, into the 24/7 news cycle in a matter of a day or two. And this is an extreme development, the fact that we've reached 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. Pre-industrial levels were about 286 parts per million. We've already raised them to 400 now. We are fairly confident that you probably have to go back at least 4 million years and perhaps as long as 10 million years to find a time in the Earth's past when CO2 concentrations were as high as they are now. This is the highest CO2 concentration we've seen in the history of human civilization.
And, of course, the nature of it, since it's being generated and it takes a while to get that concentrated in the atmosphere, there's more in the pipeline.
Right. We're not just plateauing at 400. We're shooting straight past it, and we're well on our way to 450 parts per million. We'll be there in a matter of decades if we continue with business as usual. Now, why is that important? Well, 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere is the concentration that we're fairly confident commits us to at least 2 degrees Celsius, that's almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit, warming of the globe relative to pre-industrial time. When climate scientists look at the projected impacts of climate change, it's often that figure is often pointed to as where we start to cross the threshold of truly dangerous and irreversible changes in our climate.
Well, it's clear that, as I mentioned, that the president is distracted. But doesn't this require some serious leadership to point out how alarming this situation is? And yesterday I covered an interesting story that's coming out of the International Energy Agency that just released a report saying that there's been a global tectonic shift in the world energy markets where the United States will surpass Russia in 2015, which is only a couple of years away, in terms of being the world's biggest producer of gas. This is because of the fracking that's going on. Right. And that the U.S. will become energy self-sufficient very soon, and it'll move within a decade from a net importer to a net exporter. And clearly, this is a big story. So why is it not that the president is using this as a way, you know, get a plan going, get a Manhattan Project going, get a man on the moon thing going, instead of being on the defensive all the time?
Well, yeah. You know, he, you know, in recent months, you know, since his reelection to a second term, The president often has been more forceful in the language that he's used to characterize the threat of climate change, and he's been more willing to call out climate change deniers. In fact, he just tweeted yesterday calling them out for basically trying to prevent the approval of the new EPA administrator, Gina McCarthy. So, you know, the president, I think, is trying to do what he can to both to speak out about the issue, and within the administration, you know, they've been taking actions, the EPA, in sort of tightening restrictions on coal-fired power plants. They are trying to do what they can, but obviously, in order to pass a climate bill, we need, you know, a Congress that is willing to engage in good faith efforts to deal with this problem. And frankly, right now we have a Congress, a House of Representatives, where the Science Committee, the House Science Committee, is led by somebody who denies that climate change is even real. And how can we have that important debate that we need to have about how to solve the problem if we can't even admit that the problem exists? And so with the current congressional makeup, it's difficult to see how a climate bill gets passed. What that probably means is that we'll need to see a change in the congressional makeup. You know, if we are going to pass legislation to deal with this problem, meanwhile, the president has to do everything he can from the executive side to try to deal with our carbon emissions.
Again, I speak with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website, realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Well, I'm not meaning here, Michael, to put everything on Obama's shoulders here. In fact, when you just pointed out the know-nothing that runs the Science Committee on the Republican chair of the Science Committee, I think the real point here is that why do we as a country and a culture, and particularly our press, tolerate such flagrant and irresponsible ignorance? And why do we not call these buffoons out for their idiotic anti-intellectualism? I mean, we don't have time for this nonsense of balance, you know, fair and balanced, for God's sake. What the fair and balanced binary notion in our press has done, it's allowed the Koch brothers and the climate deniers to equate their non-science with real science for equal and opposite arguments. It's allowed the creationists to say that they're just the other argument up against evolution. I mean, you know, this is the thing that's driving me nuts, is that why do we pussyfoot around people like these know-nothings in Congress? I mean, and of course, in the Senate, you've got Imhoff, who's a proud denier. They should be pilloried. They should be put in the stocks, for God's sake, not treated as reasonable human beings and important lawmakers.
Well, you know, we are faced, for example, with the prospect right now of the Koch brothers purchasing the L.A. Times. If you've been reading the headlines recently, the Koch brothers are trying to buy the Tribune newspaper syndicate. And if they are successful in doing that, it means that we will have, you know, even fewer independent voices within the media to cover this issue with, you know, objectivity and accuracy, right? Because objectivity and accuracy trumps balance when it comes to good journalism. And it's important for there to be reasonable balance, for reasonable viewpoints of both sides to be represented in the discussion. But the foremost responsibility of a journalist is to report accurately and objectively. And I feel like we've regressed in the way that we cover matters of policy relevant science. You know, there was this famous quote attributed to Patrick Moynihan, the former New York senator: "You're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts." And we've entered into a realm now in our public discourse on climate change and an array of issues where many feel that they're entitled to their own facts. And, you know, there's a whole cable network, you know, that is willing to report things, you know, to provide an alternative universe where the laws of physics don't apply anymore and where science is no longer represented accurately. That's a real challenge to have, you know, the sort of debate we need to have about the policy matters involved, what to do about the problem, when, you know, people increasingly can sort of isolate themselves into a bubble of disinformation. They can, you know, get all of their information from sources that are not willing to cover this issue from a factually based perspective. It's a problem.
Well, I mentioned, Michael Mann, the revolution that's taking place in the global energy markets as the U.S. In a couple of years surpasses Russia to become the world's biggest supplier of gas, most of which will be domestic, most of which will go into power generation and perhaps into fleets of trucks, etc., and even cars. I mean, in other countries like Australia, you can go to the gas station and you can get natural gas alongside gasoline. It's a lot cheaper, and it pollutes, I think, 50% less in terms of global warming. I'm not suggesting it's a panacea, but at least it's a step in the right direction. But here we have, in Los Angeles, you got Al Gore and Villaraigosa, outgoing mayor, congratulating themselves over the fact that they're closing down the coal-fired plant in the Mojave that supplies much of Southern California's electricity. But they're not going to do that for 15 more years. We don't have 15 years. We don't have any time. The latest figures indicate we're past the point where we should be dealing with this.
Right. You know, if we look at the current CO2 concentration, which we were talking about earlier, 400 parts per million, as I said, you've got to go back 4 million years to find CO2 concentrations we know were that high in the past. And we also know that at that time, the globe was several degrees warmer than it is right now. Sea level was about 100 feet higher than it is right now. So even if we were to keep CO2 sustained at the current level, we could easily commit ourselves to dangerous and irreversible changes in the climate. So the fact is that there's already potentially too much carbon in the atmosphere, and simply, you know, transitioning from one fossil fuel to another fossil fuel, it isn't going to solve the problem. It's true that nominally natural gas produces about 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions that coal burning does, although there are some uncertainties, there are some caveats, because some of the natural gas leaks into the atmosphere during the process of natural gas recovery. And natural gas itself is, you know, primarily methane. It's also a powerful greenhouse gas. So that's an important caveat. We still don't have, you know, firm measurements of that effect. Now, the fact is that just transitioning from one fossil fuel to another fossil fuel doesn't accomplish what we need to do, as you've alluded to. We need to actually bring our emissions to a peak and ramp them down dramatically if we are going to avoid crossing the next critical threshold. We've already crossed 400. We're well on our way to 450 ppm. And when we pass 450 ppm, the model projections tell us that's when we really start to see the worst effects of climate change kick in.
So is that what it's going to take, though, for us to literally see vast areas of the globe underwater before we wake up? I mean, give us a sense of how quickly this bubble of denial, as we continue our lifestyle and our carbon-based lifestyle, if you will, and at what point do we as a species realize that we have basically blown it here on this planet?
Well, that's the problem. The problem is that we have already put enough warming into the pipeline that it's possible that we've already committed to the melting of a large part of the major ice sheets, the Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheet, enough to give us, you know, 5-6 meters ultimately of sea level rise. Now, it may take centuries for that to play out, because the processes involved are slow. But that means that the emissions that we are, you know, producing right now may already be pushing us past the threshold where we cross the point of no return, where we are committed to that amount of sea level rise. That's the problem with, climate change and carbon emissions. There is this very long time scale involved in the response. There is what we call the committed warming. We, through our emissions right now, are creating changes that will take centuries to finally occur. That means that we can't see the full impact of what we're doing at the moment. It's the tip of the iceberg. All we see is the tip of the iceberg.
Well, but there's enough. I mean, even the Hurricane Sandy indicated that things had changed. I mean, you'd have to be
absolutely
totally unconscious not to notice that we've had these multiple traumatic weather events, and they're increasing in frequency and in damage.
Yeah, we know, for example, the most exhaustive economic analysis that's been done to date indicates that we are already losing worldwide about $1 trillion of GDP annually. That's about 2% of our gross domestic product is just being squandered because of the impacts, the negative impacts of climate change. And we've seen those impacts play out in a devastating way here in the U.S. over the last year. If you think back to last summer, the record heat and drought and the resulting wildfires out west, the precipitous decline in Arctic ice at the end of the summer, which we think influenced the atmosphere in a way that might have actually made Sandy more likely, that might have influenced the trajectory, the devastating trajectory that, Superstorm Sandy took, rather than sort of curving out into the open ocean as most hurricanes do. It actually moved west towards the coast of New Jersey, New York City. So we have these reminders of the impact that climate change is already having. And like I said, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. We may be committing to far more devastating changes in the future if we don't turn things around within a few years. Now, the good news is that we do think there is still time to turn things around. We do think that we can avoid crossing that 450 parts per million threshold if we take action now. But there is a greater urgency than there has ever been before.
Well, just in closing, Michael Mann, it's difficult to understand why Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox, who are the big disinformation peddlers here, why he does what he does. I mean, we can just put it down to malevolence, because as a business model, it doesn't make any sense. But you understand why the Kochs do what they do, because they're in the oil business. And sure, they just want to make money, and they don't care about posterity. So we've got insurance companies out there who are losing money. You mentioned $1 trillion going out of GDP. So is there a possibility that there's going to be some powerful economic interests that'll step up and counter the Kochs and the Murdochs?
Sure. I mean, ultimately, I think we will see a battle of the of the titans, as it were, with the fossil fuel interests on the one side, but the insurance industry, the reinsurance industry, the national security community, because they are extremely worried about the national security threat associated with ongoing climate change. And, you have other industries as well that can see that they are going to be negatively impacted by climate change. And that's not even taking into account the fact that, ultimately corporations, are led by CEOs who, also have children and grandchildren. And one hopes that they're thinking about the legacy that they're leaving behind for, the next generation. So I do hold out hope that we will, we will meet this challenge. The worry is that the disinformation campaign that's being waged by the Koch brothers and others and the Murdoch empire, may delay action enough to where we already commit to far more devastating impacts than we would have if we had acted now. And so there's a real cost in the delay of action, and that is playing out right now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Mann.
Thank you. It's always good to talk with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He is the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org, and in 2007 he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.